It's a long way to Tipperary, to the sweetest girl I know.
The music of the First World War classic, Long Way to Tipperary, reminds us this is the 100th anniversary of the armistice which ended World War I, and this is a special Remembrance Day memorial from The Rock. In September, a very special display opened in Saltcoats that was called From Vimy to Juno. Amongst the artifacts that were found there, a young woman from Saskatoon, visiting with her husband, found a picture of a man, turned out it was her uncle. I spoke with Lisa Oliver. Her husband Jim is from Saltcoats. They were visiting her mother when she found a picture of her First World War uncle, Hugh Cairns, who was a Victoria Cross winner. Well, on June 11, 1941, thousands of people, probably exceeding the population of Yorkton of that day, thousands came out to see an historic event, the official opening of the new wartime airport under the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan. Canadians and the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan were key in the Allied victory over the Nazis, a fact acknowledged publicly in a speech by the famous Winston Churchill. Many BCATP pilots, navigators, and men who had become bomb aimers and gunners trained right here in Yorkton. But what happened one moonlit night over Germany 75 years ago is just one of the events in which Canadians were central players. The night of April 16, 1943, included a full moon, but as far as the airmen were concerned, had a little else going for it. 133 very young men of 617 Squadron, who took off in 19 specially modified Avro Lancaster bombers, formed up and flew extremely low over the English Channel across the Dutch coast. According to Ottawa aviation history writer Dave O'Malley, wrote, "Having trained for months to deliver a very special weapon, these young men were headed for a date with destiny. The aircraft would fly low beneath radar coverage, navigate deep into Germany, locate and attack a series of massive dams on the tributaries of the Ruhr River. Behind each of those dams, the Mon, the Sorpe, the Eider, and the Ennepe were massive reservoirs of water, which it was hoped would flood factory sites downstream and bring much of Germany's industrial production to a standstill. The attacks would be carried out using a special explosive device, which, when released from a Lancaster bomber at exactly 60 feet, at exactly 240 miles an hour, and at a specific distance from the reservoir side face of the dam, it would fall to the water, bounce like a skipping stone in decreasing bounces until it fell exactly at the face of the dam. The bombs would then sink down the face of the dam to a specific depth where a hydrostatic sensor would detonate the bomb like a depth charge. And like a depth charge, the bomb would use the power of compressed water to deliver a devastating blow deep beneath the surface, weakening the dam's structural integrity. The massive weight of the stored water would then breach the weakened dam and roar down the valleys, flooding industrial complexes downstream. Now, there have been several movies as well as books, magazines, articles, even novels about the event, but Toronto-area writer Ted Barris has updated the story and the special part Canadians played both as trainers of the crews and actual dam busters.
The vulnerability of the Ruhr River dams in Germany, in the heart of Nazi Germany, the Third Reich's sort of military-industrial complex, had been known to the Allies for a long time. The problem was they were protected by a lot of ground batteries and so on, but also by torpedo nets in front of the reservoirs to, you know, essentially deflect any attack on the water or under the water by torpedoes. So that what was needed was a delivery system that would bring a bouncing bomb, which Barnes Wallace invented in the early 40s through the beginning of the war, to deliver explosives sufficient enough to blow the dams. Well, training occurs once the story of the actual bomb is explored, and we discover that he gets the nod ultimately, thanks to another Canadian, and I'll leave your listeners to read that in the book as to how that happened. The other half of the equation is getting the crews to deliver the bombs aboard 19 Lancasters, which are dispatched from England on the night of the 16th of May, 1943. There are 133 airmen in those 19 Lancasters, and scattered across the 19 Lancasters are a quarter of the crewmen who are Canadian. In other words, about 30 men who had been pilots and navigators and radio operators and bomb aimers and flight engineers, all trained in Canada. In fact, half of the dam's raid crews were trained in Canada, nearly 56 of them, I believe. And so in many, many ways, the unheralded heroes in the midst of the dam's raid airmen are Canadians whose stories have never been recognized. Well, that's what I'm changing this year by bringing this book out.
The crews included RAF personnel of several different nationalities, as well as members of the Royal Australian Air Force, Royal Canadian Air Force, and the Royal New Zealand Air Force, who were frequently attached to RAF squadrons under the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan. With just moonlight to guide them, the air crews found their targets and flew into heavy flak and cannon fire from batteries of anti-aircraft guns. These batteries were mounted with commanding field of fire advantage on the dam sites. What's different about this book from the other accounts of the Dam Buster story? Let's ask researcher-writer Ted Barris.
On a very basic level, what most stories of the Dam Busters don't give you are the personalities of the men involved. We hear about Guy Gibson, who was the man who led the squadron. We hear about Barnes Wallace, wonderfully characterized by Richard Todd and Michael Redgrave in the movie. But we don't know about the average airman who took part in the raid. And the 7.5 weeks of intense training, which took place between the end of March 43 and the actual raid, in addition to which, I make the case for the reality that had Guy Gibson and Barnes Wallace not had the benefit of the training that had gone on in Canada, you, I'm sure, in Saskatchewan know very well about the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan. Well, the BCATP trained 250,000 men. Half the men in the raid on the dams had been trained in Canada. Yes, 30 of them were Canadian, but many, many more from Australia, New Zealand, and Britain came to Canada to be trained in those trades, and they were so good at it, Guy Gibson chose them for the raid. So that's the unknown, the variable that most people don't realize. And there are other Canadian elements in the story that have gone virtually unnoticed, which I bring to bear.
In the current era, families of the Dam Buster Canadians have provided surprising and exclusive material for Ted Barris and his version of the Dam Busters.
I mean, I have photographs taken by a wireless radio operator, a guy named Albert Garshowitz from Hamilton. He died on the raid, but he took photographs of the training which existed in his family's archives, and I've reproduced in the book, and they've never been seen before.
Ted Barris released first copies of his book, Dam Busters, in August this year at a special reunion of families and friends of Dam Buster crews. They met at Nanton, Alberta, about 25 miles south of Calgary, where, thanks to the foresight and sacrifice of Dam Buster families and local volunteers, the Canadian Bomber Command Museum pays tribute to the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan and wartime Canadian crews. Local volunteers salvaged and over the years have completely restored an Avro Lancaster bomber. I was privileged to see and hear them fire up four thunderous engines at a ceremony August 25th this past summer. That's also where I met Cher Fraser and her mother, Doris. Cher's dad was aboard one of the Lancasters that never returned.
So here we are at the Dam Buster reunion in Nanton. And go ahead and tell me your names.
I'm Doris Fraser.
Doris?
Cher Fraser.
And so, why are you here?
Well, we're here to honor and remember the anniversary of the dams raid, RAF 617 Squadron, and to remember all those that served and paid the ultimate sacrifice for our freedom. So we are here to remember.
Right. And there was one member of the crew that was particularly special to you.
Yes, my father.
Who was he?
John Fraser, and he was John Hopgood's bomb aimer.
So, Doris, if I can ask you, you were married just before
John joined up with. Was that, or he had joined up?
We were married on the 29th of April. I guess it was 1943.
So, did you know there was something special in this mission that he was on?
I knew he was.
Go ahead.
I knew it was going on some special, something special, but he couldn't say anything about it.
Obviously.
Yeah.
Right. I'm almost lost for words, ladies. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
So, what's John's story as far as the with the Dam Busters?
Well, it was a most unexpected event because after he did a full tour with 50 Squadron, he was, you know, he was pretty solid with the crew that he had. They'd done, you know, 30 sorties, and he was very comfortable with his accomplishment. But I think he was expecting to have 2 weeks off, and they needed a rest period, and he was going to get married to my mom.
Yes.
But a telegram that said, return to unit immediately, happened within a few days of his crew rest. And basically, he was off. He had to go off to Scampton, leave his base, and start with a whole new crew. And they weren't told what they were going to be doing, and so it was all a secret up until, I think it was either, technically I'm not sure on this, but about a day before. So really, you know, newly married, young, it was quite a shock and change, but he could handle it because he was very calm, and he was a very intelligent, calm man, so he could handle the stress.
So now, his plane was one of the casualties?
Yes, it was. It was the second aircraft to attack the Myrna Dam. It had been hit by enemy fire before it got to the dam, but good old Hoppy said, let's continue and get the job done. So they did. They were the second to go in after Guy Gibson's crew, and they were hit very heavily by the flak gunners on the dam. And what happened was my dad wanted to do basically a dummy run and go around again, but Hoppy said, let go.
Okay, yeah.
So they did. They let go. And consequently, because of all the mayhem, the mine dropped just a little bit late, and it ended up going over the dam and hit the power station, which created a huge fire. And in that sense, in many ways, it helped them to complete the task of breaching the dam. But unfortunately, what happened was Hoppy, you know, tried very, very hard to keep the aircraft up high enough so that some of the crew could get out. But tragically, he lost his life. Five other crew members lost their lives. Tony Bircher and my father were the only two to get out. And as my father tried to get out, it was almost impossible. You can just imagine he was almost at tree height, and he opened the chute inside the bomb aimer's hatch so that it could catch the slipstream of air, and he got out, and within seconds he was right on the ground, and he was uninjured. It's an absolute miracle. I mean, to this day, every time I say it, I get almost my heartbeat pumps because I'm thinking, how did he do it? It's a miracle.
Was he captured immediately?
No, he wasn't. He was on the run for approximately 8 to 10 days, and he evaded the Germans for long enough. However, he got to Wesel on the Rhine, almost at safety, occupied Holland, but safe, and they caught him right near the border. And so...
Yeah. So... So he spent some time in prison camp.
2 years. 2 years. And he was in Stalaglov 6, Stalaglov 3, and then after the long winter march, they ended up in Luchenwald.
And you have his diary from that time?
Yes, I do.
Yeah.
Yeah, the POW diary, perhaps, with the letters from POW camp, are, to me, probably the most profoundly informative, and really they just really touch your heart, because you can hear back in that day they didn't talk about post-traumatic stress.
Yeah.
They didn't talk about it.
Yeah.
But because I've studied PTSD a lot through Wounded Warriors, I could now look through all of these letters, especially the ones right after the raid and he got caught. I can see and hear the post-traumatic. And it's interesting because I think a lot of people wouldn't understand it, but, you know, he was actually feeling guilt that he survived, you know.
No doubt. As we've heard and we've all read books and seen movies and so forth about the treatment that some of these prisoners got, what was his story?
You know, I feel that his he never really complained much in his letters. He talked about living behind the wire, but he didn't say very much in terms of being mistreated. I think the Red Cross parcels were a lifesaver. I think that the Red Cross really was what made the biggest difference there. And I think he didn't write much and say too much about it because all the letters were read by the Germans anyhow. So he got very ill when he returned back to Canada because of the malnutrition. So I think that spoke for itself in terms of treatment. I think if you look at that and see how ill he got when he started eating northern Western food and how rich it was, he had a burst appendix and almost died. Mm-hmm. So that spoke volumes.
I see. So can you tell me about his repatriation? Let's say, not the end of the story, but the end of his incarceration and coming home?
Yeah, coming home, I think he wanted to find himself a forest and wanted to go back to being a bush rat, pretty much. There was a lot of solace and comfort in nature and just getting back to British Columbia, you know. And he demobilized in October of 43, but the reason for that was also because of his burst appendix and, you know, illness.
I see. So I guess what I'm getting at is, how did they get out of the prison camp and back to...
That's quite a story.
Okay, what's that story?
How much time do you have?
Well, whatever you can give me.
Well, in the last days of the war, and when they were... Basically, when... I forget the name of the day, but it was in April. Anyhow, they were basically set free. But the commander that was overseeing them all basically had said, stay put. There's landmines, there's, you know, do not leave Luchenwald. Well, my dad was not quite happy with that. So out of the 12 that were in their hut, two of them took off. My dad was one of them. Once again, that speaks volumes, his actions. He's out of there. And what he did was he took off and basically he found a way to get to the Americans. And the Americans helped him. They gave him a jacket. They helped him. He actually got back to England earlier than the rest of them. And when he got to England, what he did was he took off straight to Doncaster, and he didn't tell my mother, and he showed up on her doorstep, and she fainted. Because this is the man he was.
Wow.
He was just, that kept him alive in prisoner of war camp. So he wasn't hanging around.
Yeah.
And once he got back there, of course, Mom can tell you she fainted. She can say that herself. But what was interesting was Dad went back to visit John Hopkins' mother in the village of Shear, which I'm named after. And he went back to see her and pay his respects for the man that saved his life. So it's quite a story. And then within, I think it was August of 43, they put him on a boat, I think, out of Bournemouth. And back to Canada.
Tragically, Cher Fraser's father, John Fraser, was killed while flying for the BC Forestry Service in the early 1950s after his return from the war. But her mother, Doris, whom we heard in that interview as well, also became a pilot, the first woman licensed to fly out of Nanaimo Airport. So we asked Ms. Fraser to explain the draw, which took she and her 93-year-old mother from Victoria, B.C. to Nanton this past summer.
Without belaboring the point, what makes it so special to you?
Well, first of all, I would have to say camaraderie, you know, being with other Danbuster families. And it's, you know, 75 years ago this event took place in May of 43. many of these families I've never met. So that is a huge highlight. And to interact with them and continue to have that relationship with them is really big. It's huge. And to be here where this museum and the people of this museum are so passionate about remembering the people, not just the machine, the people, that just makes it very heartwarming to come back here.
Is he remembered in his hometown with any kind of a bridge or a street or anything?
Well, funny you should say that, because someone just recently from Nanaimo just picked up the torch, the John Fraser torch. And he is just, why is he not remembered here in Nanaimo? And so what's happening is he's talking to the mayor and a few politicians, but strangely enough, Victoria, the BC Aviation Museum,
yes,
just acquired the Lancaster, which has been a big thing in the news. It's the Lanc that was in the city of Toronto, and it's now been awarded to the BC Aviation Museum. What is exciting about it is that this fellow, his name is Rick Zimmerman, he has said, I'm going down to the BC Aviation Museum and introducing them to the John Fraser story. Well, they want to take on the John Fraser story and tie it in with the arrival of the Lancaster. So I think we're going to see some exciting things ahead on Vancouver Island.
Well, listen, thank you both for talking to me.
Nice to meet you.
Enjoy the rest of the event.
Thank you.
Thanks.
But then to close the loop on this story, we were able to capture a moment when the Frasers and other Dambuster family members received a surprise gift. Rick Featherstone is one of the Nanton Museum volunteers who has researched his own grandfather's war experience. In this audio, the reference to Lancaster AJM is the plane in which John Fraser and his crewmates went down as they attacked one of the Ruhr Valley dams.
Just to have something my grandfather was a part of. When our museum decided to change the markings on our Lancaster to commemorate AJM, I had to know more about the aircraft and the story behind it. I searched the internet for names and such and came across this amazing story of AJM. I was hooked and wanted to know more. Then I came across a website that was offering cufflinks made by a jeweler from melted down pieces of AJM. I got in contact with the jeweler and asked, how would I know that these are actually from that Lancaster? Anyone could say they had something like that. The response that I got was a surprise, and I read, it is absolutely fair to ask about the provenance, and so understanding how I came to possess the fragments of ED-925 may be helpful. Some years ago, I was contacted by Diane Johnson, who was selling her deceased father, Alan Brown's, collection of World War II aviation artifacts. Alan was a leading British aviation archaeologist who led many of the digs after the war, often with his daughter Diane. On one such dig, Alan and Diane went to Germany and were able to discover some of the remains of AJM at the crash site. He subsequently erected a memorial at the site, which the jeweler still believes is there today. The small fragments that I have were in Alan's personal collection, labeled and mounted. A larger piece had also been previously presented by Alan to one of the crew, who he believes was Bircher, who then gave it to Squadron Museum, where it's on display today. The jeweler then went on to tell me that he would like to donate these cufflinks and a larger piece of AJM to our museum because they needed a good home. I thought it would be a great idea to give this piece of history to a member of the family whose loved ones were aboard AJM that night. The museum directors all felt this was a great idea. Could I please have Sheer Fraser, daughter of John Fraser, AJM bombaimer, Jim Heather, nephew of Ken Earnshaw, AJM navigator, and Andrea Davids, who I'm not sure is here, granddaughter of Charles Brennan, AJM flight engineer, up to the front here to get their piece of history.
In the 75 years since the night of May 16, 1943, the Dam Buster story has been made into feature films, documentaries, novels, nonfiction books, magazine articles, dramatic paintings, computer games, marches, and comic books. The latest, by Toronto author Ted Barris, is subtitled Canadian Airmen and the Secret Raid Against Nazi Germany. It's published by HarperCollins. Ted Barris has written 17 best-selling books. The Nanton Bomber Command Museum of Canada is well documented on web pages and on Facebook. As far as we know, only one of the Dam Buster crew members' survivors is still alive. Fred Sutherland still lives with his family in Peace River, Alberta. He also survived several other major raids, although he was the lone survivor from a Lancaster shot down on a later bombing raid. With the help of the Dutch, French, and Spanish underground, he made his way to Gibraltar and was repatriated in England, eventually returned home to his family in the Peace River. Ted Barris, again, has written 17 best-selling nonfiction books, including a reworking of The Great Escape from Nazi prison camps from a Canadian perspective. That version of O Canada was played August 25th by the Armed Forces Band from Cold Lake, Alberta, marking the 75th anniversary of Canadian contributions to the Dam Buster raid on Germany's industrial heartland, the Ruhr Valley. And as we discussed in the Dam Buster segment, the British Commonwealth Training Plan, BCATP, opened in Yorkton in 1941. It was applauded by no less than Winston Churchill as a major factor in the Allied Second World War victory over Nazi Germany. To get a better picture of that massive international undertaking, we turned again to aviation history expert writer Dave O'Malley at Vintage Wings Canada near Ottawa.
First of all, in your opinion, was it decisive in the war effort?
Oh, it certainly was. In fact, it's long been recognized as Canada's greatest contribution as it was happening and after the war. That's what Canada planned to do, is to train the bulk of the air crew, pilots, gunners, navigators, bomb aimers, and the like, radio operators. And it was a massive undertaking that inside of 2 years from the time they signed the documents with other members of the Commonwealth countries like Norway and France, from the time they signed that document to the time that the all of these bases were in operation was a little over 2.5 years. And in that time, they scouted out, surveyed, and leveled and built about 150 training facilities from coast to coast. And then in that time as well, they acquired the aircraft, the instructors, they built the buildings, built the all of the facilities, all done in an unbelievable amount of time and without the use of email.
Yeah, indeed. And I often think, and without the USA, of course, at the outset, the Americans were not involved in the war. Was that why they were not included?
Yes, exactly. They were simply not involved in the war. Certain manufacturers knew that they could contribute to the war effort. I think the company that made Link Trainers was an American company. And these are the simulated airplane trainers, a very small little compact machine that people sat inside and flew. Looks a little bit like a carnival toy.
I've seen pictures.
Yeah, and that the American company that created that knew that they would want to build them for the British Commonwealth Air Training Plan. I mean, there would be a requirement for literally thousands of these things. So they set up a factory in Brockville, Ontario, across the border, and manufactured them for all of the Commonwealth there. And as well as some of the aircraft, like the Harvard aircraft, which were used extensively for service flying training, were built in America and shipped to Canada. Sometimes they were shipped to the border because they couldn't be crossed, and literally they were dragged across the border and flown out of there and dragged across by hand or by horses in some cases.
Wow. Now, Dave, as far as Canada embracing this, my reading of Canadian history and my understanding, after the First World War, there was a lot of shock at the appalling numbers of Canadians that were killed and that whole scenario. So did Canadians were they immediately ready to, let's say, embrace this the European conflict and the BC-ATP?
Well, they certainly were. And at the time, there were Canadians already in the Royal Air Force who had signed on as members of the Royal Air Force. They were not in the RCAF. They went overseas in the mid-30s, from 37 to 39, joined the RAF, and contributed greatly to the Battle of France and the Battle of Britain. And in fact, there's, I think, 140 Canadian pilots who flew missions or at least one operation during the Battle of Britain, many of them becoming some of the most standout aces, like Willie McKnight of Calgary. So, and at the time, the Canadian government wanted, and the British thought it was wise as well, to form a squadron made up of Canadians, so that Canadians, you know, this would be in late 1939, so that Canadians could follow the exploits of their Canadian pilots in the Battle of Britain. It was a very famous squadron led by Douglas Batter, the legless fighter pilot.
Yes. I guess one of the side benefits for we in Canada, there's been a lot of talk about immigration. There were young pilots and I guess other crew that came from all around the world, and it was quite as a side benefit, it was quite an immigration. I know certainly in the Yorkton area there are still a few of those guys that immigrated here, flew with the BC-ATP that are still here and raised their families here.
Yep, they came from all over the world. They did not come immediately. Some of the bases for the RAF, for British pilots, were run by the RAF in Alberta specifically, and some in Saskatchewan. These were operated by the RAF and not by the RCAF. And a lot of young British trainees came over here, learned their trades, went back. Some of them, in fact, I wrote a story about that on our website, a young guy who came over here as a mechanic at Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, and, of course, at the end of the war went back and was disillusioned by, I think he lived in a pretty industrial city like Hull or Sheffield or something, and he was disillusioned, and he loved his memory of Saskatchewan. He came back and set up a life in Moose Jaw. So, I mean, that's just one story of thousands and thousands of these stories.
Exactly. Now, I guess what strikes me too, Dave, when I read about this, on June 11th, 1941, was the opening of the Yorkton Flying Services Flying Training School. And apparently there were 11,000 people turned out. Now, I'm not sure, but I would guess Yorkton's population would be under 10,000 at that time. So it was obviously a huge hit with the public.
Yes, well, it certainly was. And in fact, when the announcement came out that Canada would participate in the war, primarily with this undertaking of these training bases, small towns and large cities across the country basically lobbied very enthusiastically, because they understood the economic impact of these facilities in the immediate economic impact of these facilities. There would be young men coming in, going to the bars, buying clothes, getting haircuts, and but they didn't realize was the long-term economic benefit of that. Many of these airports, many of these towns, in fact, nearly all of them, except for cities like Regina and maybe Winnipeg and Toronto, they had no airport. And today, a lot of the airports in some of the major cities like Vancouver and even Pearson, that was a BC ATP airfield built in the late 30s and early 40s. And today, like I'm in Ottawa here, and there's a small town north of here called Arnprior. That was a flying instructor school during the war. It was built at that time, and today it houses industries that supply aerospace technology to Boeing and helicopters, and it's an economic driver to this day. And they never realized that then.
One of our last remaining World War II D-Day veterans farmed for many years in the Norquay area. Bob Abbott actually was raised in the Weeks area of northeast Saskatchewan. As soon as he turned 18, like many other young men, he signed up to join the armed forces in World War II. He trained first as a motor mechanic. His first overseas assignment involved fierce fighting in France and Holland, including the bloody campaign to retake the port of Antwerp from the heavily entrenched Germans. Later, he did become a driver. Along the way, he met a young Scottish girl, just 18, and this is their story.
So this is with Millie Abbott. So, Millie, first of all, I'd like to know how you and Bob met.
Oh, we met in Dundee, May the 8th, and we all had to wear something red, white, and blue to say the war was over. And these soldiers would walk up behind me, and one said, "I wonder what the front looks like." And that was it, and we've been married for 72 years.
So you had a little period of courtship before you were
not
married.
Too much, no, because he went back.
Yeah.
We never got together too often. And we got married. I was in May. We got married in January the next year because I had to be 18. Mm.
So how old were you when you met? 17?
17.
Yeah.
And Bob had to get permission from his mom to marry me. And I had to get permission from the headmaster of our school, which is Margaret Trudeau's grandfather.
Right, Sinclair. But you were also working at the time,
yes,
weren't you?
Yes, I was, yes, yeah.
What sort of work were you doing?
A housekeeper.
Yes?
Yeah, and I don't know what else we did. Yeah.
Well, how did you know he was the one?
I don't know. He wrote to me, and I thought, well, he knew what he wanted.
Yeah.
I wasn't too sure, and he never met my parents, so he came for the wedding.
Yeah. So what did you wear at the wedding?
Oh, a white dress.
Yeah. There's the picture.
Yeah, it's all up there. And Heather was my bouquet and tulips. And we had a piper playing at the wedding.
Mm-hmm.
And my grandparents were there. They came with their horse and buggy.
And you had a band?
And we had a band at one end of the hall and the piper at the other.
Mm. What was the first dance that you and Bob danced?
I forget what waltz it was. We did okay.
Yeah,
we did.
Well, I'm looking at your picture. You're a pretty darn good-looking couple.
Oh, I wouldn't say that.
Oh, yeah. So you must have thought, wow, this big, handsome Canadian here.
Oh, God, yeah, I thought I was getting I don't know what I thought I was getting, but... Yeah, it was the name of the band.
The band was what?
McCandy. That was the end of my name.
I see.
Yeah. And the only thing that upset me is when I left home.
I'm sure.
Yeah. You just never know you'll ever see them again at that age.
Yeah. So why did your parents agree to let you marry this wild Canadian?
I really don't know, but I did feel sorry for him when I left. Yeah.
Now, you had family at home, other siblings at home at the time?
Yes. Yeah. I had a brother in the services, too.
Yeah.
So
what did you have for supper at your wedding night?
Oh, we had beef and turnips and neeps and tatties.
What are neeps?
But turnips.
Oh, okay.
And trifles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And everybody pitched in to bring it because we were very poor.
Right.
Yeah.
So then Bob had to go, did he have to go back to France after that?
Yeah, he did. Yeah. He went
Germany.
Back to Germany. He went back to Germany, And then he came back in September, was it September?
Yeah.
And then for the wedding in January.
Yeah. So What did you think you were coming to in Canada?
I really didn't have a clue, yeah. But I can tell you it was horrible.
So I've read a bit of the story, but yeah. So like Warbride, you came on the boat and then on the train from Halifax?
Yeah, and I got as far as Winnipeg, and then I was on my own after that. The train went on and through the rest of the way, and Bob couldn't meet me. Two places he couldn't meet me, so they dumped me off in a little shack and told me to stay here till a freight came through.
And where about was that shack, do you know?
Crooked River. Yeah. And I just sit and wait. There was nobody around, nothing. I hadn't eaten for 2 days. And the guys came, and they stopped at Porcupine to go for their lunch, and the guy said, can I bring you a hot dog?
That's right, yeah.
And I didn't know what a hot dog was, and I said, no, thank you. Oh, God, I could read it. And then we got to Weeks, and they knew I was coming in on this freight. There was everybody there from the Indian with the braids, everything.
Yeah.
And they were all in dark colors and scarves on their heads. And I step out with a bright red coat and a hat on. And all I said to Bob, I bet they think you married a hooker. He said, they wouldn't even know what that was.
And you were 18.
18, yes, yeah.
So... how far from the railway station to the farm?
Five and a half miles. And a wagon through water holes.
Yeah. Yeah. 5.5 miles.
Miles and a wagon, yeah.
So did you think you were coming to some big Canadian farm spread?
Well, I did, yes. But it was nothing. It was nothing. It was hard.
So did you think, I'm going back home?
I can't swim. And, you know, you couldn't phone home. You had to wait for letters. It was a rough time. Yeah.
But now, as time went on, you became part of the War Brides Association, did you?
Not really, no. Because then we raised our children and we weren't able to go. But I still keep in touch with them all.
I see.
Yeah, we've been to Regina with this painting that Bev Tosh does. I've been all over with her.
Bev?
Tosh and Calgary that paints War Brides. The one-way passage.
I see.
Yeah, so.
So did she paint you?
Oh, yes, yeah. On a piece of rough lumber.
Really?
Yeah, it's beautiful. I went to Ottawa.
Where is it?
I've got it here. I went to Ottawa. We've been all over. And she was showing it in Scotland, and we couldn't go. So I phoned Valerie McKittrick, the doctor's wife, and she went and represented me.
That was the doctor in Norquay?
In Dor.
So when did you and Bob move to Norquay?
We moved in 51 years ago.
89.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, we moved into Norquay, but I bought the farm in 62.
And we moved to the farm.
So a farm at Norquay.
Yeah.
So was that a better farm than the original homestead you were at?
Oh, yes, it was much, much better. But the only sad part is when Bob got out of the Army, he could apply for a loan with a cheaper rate, and they come to interview us, and they wouldn't pass because I didn't know one chicken from the other. I didn't know a tiller from whatever. So we were disqualified.
Oh,
we
really?
Didn't get no loan. So we had to go through the credit union to get it, to buy our land.
So, but you did it.
Oh, we did it. Yeah, we showed that we do it.
I had the credit union in Kindersley lent me the money.
To buy it.
No kidding. Was it a quarter section farm?
Half section to start with.
So do you mind telling me, or do you remember how much it was?
$8,000.
And that was what year?
1962.
Okay.
He wanted $8,500, and I offered... If I bought it before New Year's and I didn't get the loan, but he gave it to me for $88,000. Yeah. Mm.
So, Millie, then, so life on the farm now, you raised how many children?
Four. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we did good on the farm.
Yeah. But now, through the years, as you say, you kept in touch with other War Brides?
Yeah,
and
different ones. Different ones. And Bob went to all these reunions, and we met quite a few people that way.
But you've been back to Scotland?
14 times.
14 times.
Yeah. One of our sons was born over there, Ian.
Really?
Yeah.
and we registered him as a Canadian through London. But when he joined the Air Force, he was Scottish. He had to reapply for his...
Yeah. Now, I think... Now, I know Bob has gone back to France. Did you go on those trips?
We went to Holland and then places. Yeah, okay. We did. Yeah.
We've been three times in Holland, yeah. And Germany and Switzerland and all that area. Yeah.
Right. So, Millie, just I'd like to just ask you a few more questions then. So it's a dumb question, but did you ever have any regrets about leaving your family behind?
I did when I started raising mine. I thought, my cousin aren't going to do that to me. Never. Yeah. That's the only thing that bothered me, leaving home.
Obviously, your family would be really tough for them for you to leave.
Yes, it was. Yeah. But they've all been over. Yeah. But my dad died at 54, so he never got. My mom has been, and my sisters have been.
Yeah.
So, and nieces have come.
Yeah. So you still have family around Dundee?
Oh, yeah. By Aberdeen, where I'm from.
Or Aberdeen, okay.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, I get the little girl piping for me on Facebook.
Really?
Yeah. No, we keep in touch through that. Yeah.
Well, that's wonderful. Bob, can I just, I just want to make sure I've got your military story. Yeah. You landed, you were part of the D-Day effort, but you landed at Dieppe, is that correct?
Yeah. Yes, I did land at Dieppe, but I was a trade school. I was taking a mechanic, and when D-Day struck, that was finished.
Yeah.
Because they needed men, and I wasn't an infantry man at all. I was a mechanic.
But you ended up in an infantry role.
Yeah, I had to. Yeah.
What was your outfit?
SSR, South Saskatchewan Regiment.
Right. And so you saw a lot of action in France. Some pretty nasty fighting, I think.
Belgium and Holland. Was my fighting, around the port of Antwerp.
Yes.
It's 50 miles inland, the port of Antwerp, and both sides were Germans, so we had to clear them out, and that's where I was, yeah. We spent the time there cleaning the Germans out.
Mm. So at one point, though, you eventually got back to being a driver, did you?
Yes, I drove all over Germany, yes. I went when I come out of the hospital in Belgium, I went south to the forestry company, and they were hauling squares 8x8 or 6x6.
Square logs?
For bridges.
Yes.
And they were 20 feet long, So I was down there. They were sawing them things all the time. And we were under the American Ninth Army at that time.
Right. Now, you were attached to an officer at one point?
Oh, yeah.
You were his driver?
At the last, I was his driver, Major Sanger. And I never found out anything much about it. He was from Picton, B.C. And I sure would have liked to thank him because he was so good to me. And I think I took advantage of him.
Bob and Millie Abbott now live at Fairview Arms in Yorkton. One of their sons still farms near Northquay. Bob Abbott is a D-Day vet. His wife Millie was a war bride. She found her Victoria Cross uncle in Saltcoats. Volunteers of the Saltcoats Museum have turned up some fascinating stories and have earned the financial support of businesses and the general public for an innovative interactive historical display this past September-October. On October 2nd, the Saltcoats branch of the Cornerstone Credit Union turned over $500 to support the ongoing display called From Vimy to Juno. With a broad collection of pictures, artifacts, and first-person accounts from the Canadian National War Museum, and with a liberal sprinkling of locally sourced wartime materials, visitors were taken on a journey through the World War I Battle of Vimy Ridge and on to World War II France, where Canadians, of course, captured and held and advanced from Juneau Beach on D-Day, June 6, 1945. Now, on the same day, a Churchbridge family showed up at the display with a $250 donation honoring their father, a Canadian War veteran, Mark Tatton, and his wife, Joy, also a British war bride.
This is in the Vinnie Pagino display that you saw in Selkirk's. Just what are your general impressions?
Well, we were very impressed with the Selkirk's display. Lots of interesting stories, great displays, great pictures of people that have endured great sufferings, and actually just a wonderful experience for us. We hadn't quite experienced anything like that, so it was quite a pleasure to have experienced that.
So you saw a picture that you recognized instantly. Tell me about that.
Well, as we were about finished all the displays, we came around to one table where it's showing the uniforms, and I said, I'm sure this is my uncle, or my great-uncle, I guess it is. And Jim said, are you sure? And I said, yeah. Like, so I Googled it because I'd done a couple projects on it and helped my daughter with some projects on it years ago. And sure enough, the same picture came up, and it was Sergeant Hugh Cairns. And that was my grandmother's brother. So we had done some studying on it as a family. I hadn't been in much contact with anybody, but had a history of what he went through. So yeah, I recognized him right away. It was quite phenomenal that there he was. But as I say that, I'm realizing that he was one of the last people to get the Victoria Cross out of the 29 that were awarded it in Canada.
In
First World War One, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Well, that's really interesting. So it's interesting that you had done some work or some studying up on it in advance without really knowing. So is there just some things that you could share with us about Hugh Cairns?
Okay, I have, he was born in England and in 1896, and there was, I think, 11 kids in the family. Anyway, they came to Canada in 1911 when he was 14. The history of him in the war, he did go to war, I think, in his early 20s, and he was in the 46th Division Battalion, and he ended up rushing some Germans that were in a house, and he had killed 5 men at that point in this house, and then he ended up capturing 2 enemy guns, and he ended up killing 12 more Germans and 18 more prisoners. And that held off enough to help the war advance, is what my understanding is. They didn't, when he had these Germans, they didn't realize he was alone, so that's why he was able to hold them off for quite a while. But they did, once they realized he was alone, then they shot him. He had a Lewis gun, is what I understand, and they shot him in the stomach, and that ended up being his fatal wounds from the Germans. So he did receive the award after his death.
That Victoria Cross medal. Who has that medal now? Yes,
as the Victoria Cross is in Ottawa, is my understanding. I have the Mother's Cross with me. So he was only 22 years old when he died, and it was for Valenciennes, France. And he died in a vengeance, they figure, the thought was, that he lost his brother Albert 10 days before, or sorry, I think a month before that. And then he died on November 2nd.
So in your family, it's sort of the tradition has sort of has passed along, and everyone has had some insights and discussion about it, I guess.
Oh yeah, over the years. Yeah. Actually, I just reached out. There's a article that I just read, and I just reached out to probably one of my second cousins of that. So the family had kind of dispersed, and I'd like to find out more about them. So I'm going to get in contact with a couple more people in the next, hopefully, couple months and see what information I can share with them and they can share with me as well. So, but they were from Saskatoon, the Cairns family.
Right. Yeah. So I'm correct. Am I correct then? So there is an Armouries in Saskatoon that's named after you?
There is an Armouries right on 22nd Avenue, and there also is a statue of Hugh right on the 25th Avenue Bridge, right as you come off the bridge. There's a small statue there, well, a fairly sized statue there in a park, Kinsman
Park.
That's
interesting. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I must remember to check that out next time I'm in Saskatoon.
Pretty nice to see.
Their sons, Earl and Derek Tatton, handed over the donation and contributed pictures of their parents in their wartime lives. Those pictures were part of the display, which was on display for a month at Saltcoats. Then there's the story of a Saskatoon woman who was astonished to see a picture of her late uncle, her great uncle, among the shell cases, military helmets, and other memorabilia. Lisa Oliver instantly recognized Hugh Cairns, a Saskatoon schoolboy and football player whose courage and call to action later brought him top wartime honors, including the Victoria Cross. Those displays where Lisa Oliver found pictures of her great uncle were part of a display at Saltcoats called Vimy to Juno. It attracted school kids, cadets, seniors, and many others. Over 1,300 people in all, including about 600 students. International fundraising honoring Canada's wartime commitments can be found at vimytojuno.ca and at junobeach.ca. Thanks for joining us for this special Remembrance Day tribute from The Rock. I'm Jack Dawes.